Right, so which one of us is gonna intro?
Hi!
Do you want me to do it? And you wanna do it, or? Hello, welcome to our brand new show. We are Bonus Experience. I'm Monica.
I'm Ray.
The point of this show that we're doing is that we are looking beyond the play experience into the finer details of running and writing games. I am a game design professional. I work for the Onyx Path. I'm currently in the process of negotiating a contract with Weird Publishing. I've done a bunch of other indie stuff. And I like running games an awful lot.
I am a home cook, a home brewer. I got really sucked in to fixing games that weren't broken. Mostly I love, narrative stuff. I'm in the fiction writing. I've had fiction published in a White Wolf supplements, hoping to make a name for myself beyond just like fandom. And that's what I bring to the table, I suppose.
I mean, and we like each other, I guess.
I mean, I've known you for like 16 years? 16?
Is there is it in the tens of years at this point? No.
Been through
I'm
a 32. Lot of shit.
I haven't known you since I was 16. It is in the tens of years, though. It's at least a decade.
Sure.
Yeah, so this is a show and we're gonna swear. We're some foul-mouthed, intelligent ladies. We're going to swear. Die mad about it. So our first topic for this show is we're gonna break the ice. We're going to get you guys accustomed to listening to our rambly bullshit. And we're going to talk about a topic I see a lot of other people talking about, but you've never heard us talk about it. We're going to talk about running a game 101. This is going to be the basics because the rest of our show and further episodes, assuming we do further episodes, we'll go over more advanced topics. That's the point of this being bonus experience.
Collect enough and you can level up.
Mm.
Oh god.
Like fired.
Just saying it, I feel my teeth hurt.
So, why run a game at all?
Well. I only ended up running games because I think this is still a common problem, but it's not for me really anymore. Nobody else was willing to run the game.
That's
all of these players, and it would be like, fine, I guess I'll do it.
Yeah, my husband Henry is very much that guy. he's often the guy that everyone else is like, not it, and he's like, well, I like doing it, so I'll do it.
Well, yeah, I eventually came to like really love it. I now prefer running to playing, and which is a pain because now with my real life group, with my actual table group, everybody wants to run and nobody wants to play. So we have to like have this rotating schedule of who's on and who's off, and it's crazy making for me because I'm always like, now I want to run Fate. No, I want to run D&D.
I find I can't run. I mean, I can run, but I am better off running a game when I have a real solid core concept in mind. Like, I'm going to run a campaign of D&D about refugees from a kingdom that's collapsing and is under siege, and the goal is to get across the wilderness to find allies in the many disparate cities, and like you have a force of people who are trying to kill you at your back, and you have to find aid and reclaim your kingdom. Like, that's my hook, and everybody buys into that idea. And if I don't have that, then it falls apart.
That sounds pretty
cool.
Which is
not good. Like, it's sort of, and I did that. Was a game I actually ran.
Maybe one of the other things we can do is like games I want to run, but no one will let me. No one will let me. Yeah, I have to have even farther than that. I have to have like the most bizarre, quirky, specific concepts. I had a one shot that I ran that was all bards, and everyone had to pick like a certain like subset of music.
Okay.
So that they would all be different bards. So I had a moon elf who was a Ziggy Stardust analog, using the glamour college. I don't know if that's a canon one yet, or if that's still just Unearthed Arcana. But then somebody else was like the dude from Disturbed, so he was like killing people. And go, oh wow! And I have to have like very weird, very specific, quirky, bizarre concepts now, or I can't feel anything.
Oh no, you've done too much, and now you have to do weirder shit to get high.
Oh, you want to run a Monsters Only game? Ooh, yawn.
I like doing it. I like running a game because it's fun and rewarding, and I mean that. I'm at the end of the day, I'm ultimately here for collaborative storytelling. I mean, I think rules are fun, and I say this as a person who has written a lot of them and like enjoys that too. But I truly do enjoy watching people navigate a plot line and change it in ways I wasn't expecting. And like, I'm a addict for character development.
As someone who's like in the game, like specifically for like the fiction and the narrative, and watching like disparate characters like come into conflict with each other, I love even the stupid stuff, like the character that is obviously supposed to be a throwaway joke character, but you find a way to actually like make it work in your setting, and now he's got like a serious reason to be there. And I as much as it can be fun to like modify the rules to fit the stuff you're trying to create, I also just really like just coming up with a story just on the fly too, just pulling these weird bits together into something cohesive.
So I guess the answer to our question is you run the game because the rest of your group is lazy and is going to make you, or because you're the person who has the idea.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
Either the group is being held hostage and you simply must GM, or you have ideas holding your brain hostage and you simply must GM.
It's a hostage situation one way or another.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
With a little bit of Stockholm syndrome in there.
Okay.
You'll grow to love
it.
That.
I really do. So let's talk about stuff you should bring to the table, and we don't just mean your skill.
Yeah, the actual physical things, which I actually don't do a lot of. I'm one of those millennials that's killing books. I don't like to have the physical books unless it's like the core book or the player's handbook, the stuff that has like all the really important reference material that the whole group might need. If there's like digital supplements, I'm crazy for that. If there's like online compendiums, PDFs, I like to have it all just on a little tablet and then maybe next to it my phone. I don't game on site. I game usually at a There's a place in Kansas City called Pond and Pint. This is awesome, like game cafe where you can drink and play at the same time. So I don't want to carry 20 books with me. So I'll just bring my iPad.
So my opinion is the opposite. And I like if my backpack doesn't weigh 50 pounds, fuck this.
Ugh.
I like having a source book. But I'm also, let me just put a disclaimer out there. I'm also aces at using indices.
Oh, very nice.
So, like, I can sometimes beat the Control F function because I'm real good at, like, oh, that's what I'm looking for, page 46. Okay, boom, done. And I am the John Henry of book using. Put that on my epitaph. That's not a hindrance to me. I think the only book I wouldn't take with me is maybe the Exalted 3rd Edition core book.
Holy crap.
You could kill a man with that.
Just, oh my god.
I did work for Exalted, for Dragonblooded, and every time I had to reference the book, which I do prefer to reference books, I also have some eye issues. Like, I get eye strain really easy, so screen, not always the best. Take that as you will. But like just working with the Exalted book was a workout. I was like, I'm getting swole just referencing the book. Fuck.
It's, it weighs more than a sun. It's just a little appropriately enough.
It does. It's very dense.
Yeah.
But in most cases books are not that heavy. And there are some books that have a really slick form factor, like The Fate Core.
Yes. Yeah. That's a book I don't mind bringing.
Yeah, well it's you could put that in your pocket. If you had really big pockets.
But I also don't really need to bring a fate book. There's like five rules.
That's true. I mean, the current game that I'm running for my group is Through the Breach, and all those books are paperback. And they're not paperback tomes. They're like, I don't know, 200 page books ish. Okay. They're skinny and they don't weigh 50 pounds. So if I bring three of them, it's fine.
The takeaway is bring the books you think you need.
Yeah, bring the books you think you need. If you prefer.
I know that's such a nothing answer.
Right,
but
I know.
Like...
But like, if you are, I mean, and you'll trial and error. If you're the kind of person who loves using your tablet, use your tablet. My eyeballs can't take that, so I need a book. If you are also the John Henry of book using, bring a book. And if other people have copies of the same book too, even better, because then one person doesn't have to be like, I only wrote down what page number my power is on.
Bring the book you need. I don't know.
Yeah. Bring the book you need.
The first session you're gonna bring way more than you need.
Yeah.
That's just how it is. As it goes on. Yeah. As it goes on, you'll know, okay, I didn't even use that. They're not gonna be needing this. You just know you're gonna bring more than you need right away. But don't feel like I have to bring every book. Just, you know, use some PDFs or something. I don't know. I am of two minds on props. Like handouts and maps and figures. Obviously, there's some games that like require them. Like D&D is like a positional strategy combat game. You have to have something to represent your guys and something to map out movement. But as far as like I've had GMs like craft 3D models, which if you have the time. That's amazing.
Ain't nobody and, got time
but
for
it,
that.
It makes the yeah. It also makes me feel like I couldn't like I didn't make a 3D model. But then I also have another player at my table who, and you called this like fidget hell. He brings like a workbench with him, like a bag of tricks. He's always got the most random like bottle caps and those little, like, he keeps all the little plastic things that his dice come in, and he's got toothpicks and Play-Doh, and anytime you need to just like MacGyver something for a game, whether you need to have something made for like the monster in D&D or you need to like real quick like here it kind of looks like this and make something out of, you know, Play-Doh, he's just constantly pulling this stuff out of his bag. And I kind of like, I think that's a great idea, but I don't know, like, I'm already such a pack rat, I don't know if I really need,
I think,
like, justification.
I think he might be a crow that has tricked you into believing he's a human.
He's actually 75 crows
in a long coat.
In a long coat and a ponytail wig.
Yeah, no, if somebody showed up and was like, here's a bunch of weird fiddly shit to play with, I would not run the game and I would make tiny creatures out of toothpicks and Play-Doh.
It's extremely difficult when he whips out those little Play-Doh packs because they're all like individually sealed. I have no idea where you get that.
Oh, I don't know either.
But I would, if I had them, I would just like every like 20 minutes or so, just open one and just like, and just get that good Play-Doh air. It's just, it's very good to me. Are there Play-Doh scented candles?
I don't know. I mean,
I would like maybe Yankee Candle does Google that. Google it. Yeah, props are like, I would love to be somebody that uses props, but I just don't have the dedication, and I'm so busy thinking about like rules and character NPC quirks that I don't think about, like, I'm gonna craft a scroll with that I wrote with like brush ink and then tea stained. Like, no, man, this isn't like a middle school presentation. I don't know. But then the GMs that do that, I'm like, that's so cool, you made that. So I don't know. I'm a two minds on the whole thing. They're not required. Don't feel bad if you can't do it. But if you do it, it's very cool and everyone will love it.
Yeah, I gotta support the statement that like if you're playing a game that requires positioning or your players prefer to have a visualization, because we've actually played Fate with a map. And I'm making air quotes. I hope you could hear them. and like tokens,
like beyond just like the zones.
Yeah, well,
like an actual
Henry
map.
Henry got this like big unfolding dry erase mat that's not really a mat, but a series of like 3x5 cards that have been laminated, and it folds up and fits into a little bag with a marker.
Oh,
and so
that's really clever.
Yeah, it's really awesome. And so he can fold it out into like a 9x9 zone map. And write down everything on it with the dry erase marker. and bring along some other dry erase markers for like different colors or whatnot. And then we use tokens. And usually, and by tokens, I'm using that as a general term. Usually it's dice because everybody fucking has dice to, you know, indicate where we are in the zones, which doesn't necessarily mean positioning like, oh, I'm behind him because it's fate. You get to just sort of declare that. But like, I'm in this zone. My token is over here. And so right. Some people prefer to see that because they're visual. And you'll, if this is your first time running a game, you will figure that out as you go. Through the Breach is a game that's based on from a setting from a minis game, so it like kind of assumes you're going to use models, but doesn't mandate it. It's not as reliant on that as say like a D&D might be, and is like perfectly fine with you being like, he's 6 yards away from me, okay, whatever, and you can just do it in your head in the theater of the mind if you want. I ask my players, do you want to use models and a map, or do you want to just wing it, imagine everything? And they were like, no, we want a visual representation. So, we'd been using models, and I have one of those, big old mats you can wet erase on. Yes. You have one of those? Do you have one of those? They're awesome.
I do.
They're squares on one side and hexes on the other.
Two or three of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, mine is isometric on one side and squares on the other.
Oh.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, mine's fancy hex, is mine's that? Hexes on one side and squares on the other. And they were like, let's use the hex map. And I'm like, okay. So mostly what I do for that, I don't have time to... I have other crafting hobbies, so this is not my crafting hobby. So I don't make sets or anything, but like I draw on it and like I use the stage of battle and like use a little shading and whatnot to make things look a little bit three-dimensional, or like write on it six squares up. I have also used like little props to inhabit a character. I usually do this when I'm playing a PC, not an NPC. I played a mage in a mage the Awakening game, who was an awful smoker. And like chain smoking all the time. So I always had something to oral fixate with. Like I would cut up straws or like suck on a pen or.
So you had like a character prop?
Yeah, I had a character prop.
Oh, shoot. I like that.
And it like.
Ah, damn. It wasn't, I really like that.
It wasn't like. I didn't like wear a costume. I just had a thing to indicate that I was perpetually smoking.
Yeah.
And so like. When I was inhabiting the character in gesture and whatnot, like I had a thing in my hand, or I would point it at people, or like jam it out on the table and do things like that.
Well, now I got to bring like a costume trunk.
That's not a prop. That's a thing. That's an acting thing.
Well, that's a good way to like transition into talking about stuff you should bring that aren't like actual real physical things. Man, I should have started drinking. Could go get bourbon. We don't have a bourbon. I don't know why I said that.
I was like, you're in Kentucky, but you're not.
I'm not in Kentucky.
You're not in Kentucky at all.
That's, shit. Whew, boy, that's one letter that you got right.
Shut up.
Wait, no, two letters. Kentucky. Fuck. No, no. Less concrete stuff.
Right.
You should bring with you when you start GMing. Well, first you need to have some sort of, you know, confidence in your knowledge of the rules of the game you're about to run for people, or you should have the ability to fake confidence in your knowledge of the rules. Basically, when it comes down to like when I feel like, okay, I think I can actually run a game in this now, it's never a point where I'm like, I know every rule. I'm a walking encyclopedia. Basically, I know like I have memorized most of the basic rules of intended, like to the point where I could get through like 90% of any rule dispute. And that's about when I started thinking, oh, I could run this system. When it comes to like the stuff that's beyond the basic rules, I expect the players themselves to know if they're going to be playing like a very specific, like with a very specific like subsystem or mechanic, I expect them to know what they're doing. Cause I, you know, I've got a game to run. I can't be like fact-checking like every grapple attempt. I have to be like, okay, I guess, yeah, you know what you're doing. But I'm also not playing with assholes who are going to try to get the better of me every time they try to like run a new rule by me.
A lot of modern game design has moved past that. Like,
yeah,
there's a lot, like a lot of modern game design thing has moved past the fact that like a player could pull something from a random supplement and it's way better than everything else, and they're not going to tell you it's way better than everything else, and they know it is, and they're like, and then all of a sudden they're ripping your encounters apart because they picked a broken thing from, I don't know, the complete book of elves or some shit, and you know, that doesn't happen as much anymore.
Yeah, I remember having a lot of my baby's first RP experience was like a D&D 3.5 forever ago, and the friend in question had like every supplement, and I was just like, how about this one? And what I ended up playing was like just fucking ridiculous. It's like, great, D&D is really easy.
Yeah, it's like, you have a good point about the player's doing the exact opposite of what you plan for there.
Yeah, don't worry about like, there's this idea that a player is always going to do the exact opposite of whatever you have planned for. You can still plan a game that, generally speaking, your group will get down on, as long as you, again, as long as you're familiar with your players. If this is some sort of blind, like you're going to convention and six strangers filled your slot, I've never done that before. I think Monica has.
Yep.
But I don't have any experience with running for complete strangers. But if you know your players, if they're your friends, you can spend some time thinking about like, okay, well, you know, Ken really likes playing these epic combat guys that have a chance, you know, to stand in the spotlight and do something really brutal and violent and heroic. And Victoria really likes playing the troublemaker, who like specifically finds a way to get the party in trouble. So if you can kind of find these trends, you can come up with a way to get them involved. You still can't guarantee that they won't decide, I'm gonna go way over here and do this other fucking thing. But you can still kind of like, no, come on, here's, it's your favorite TV show, and I got your snacks, like it's all over here for you. I don't know.
Yeah, I find the way to deal with the expectation of that nothing will go as you planned, because it's, for me, it's about 70-30 with you guys did whatever, and 30% you did exactly what I expected. Like sometimes you'll hit that nail right on the head. You'd be like, I know what exactly how they're going to respond to this, and then you're right. But don't. That's the exception, not the rule. So my approach to this is usually to have some loose points of plot, and we will talk about this more later.
Yeah, just like your tent poles.
Right, I have tent poles, basically, like, and sometimes the tent poles don't get used. That is definitely something I'm going to talk about more later, so I'm not going to go into a ton of detail now, but I recommend having tent poles, just points of possibility that could happen. Don't think about it too much. Pitch like a sentence. You know, the necromancer will raise a skeleton army or whatever. That's a thing that can happen. And it doesn't have to happen right now, but at some point the necromancer will raise a skeleton army. And then like you keep those filed away, write them down if you're the kind of person who has to write them down. I keep them all stored in my noggin. And then use them when they come up or when they would be appropriate.
Two different ways that I would recommend to deal with if you're the kind of person who's worried about, oh, how do I plan for this? What if they don't do what I thought? What if this doesn't work? Like with the tent poles, with the set pieces, like, okay, the necromancer is going to raise an army. Have multiple paths that point towards that. Like, okay, if this happens, he can still raise the army. If this happens, he can still raise the army. So then if they do, like, go somewhere else entirely, you still have kind of a backup plan. Another thing that I really liked from, I think this is from Apocalypse World, where the whole idea of the scenario or the campaign is you plot out what will happen if the players don't do anything.
Oh, yeah,
so then you have an idea. Yeah, you have an idea of, if the players didn't get involved, how would this world go to shit? because the players are going to get involved. That's the point of the game. So then you at least know at different points, like, okay, well, they didn't deal with that, so now this is going to happen. And if you have an idea in your head of how that's going to come about visually, so they go, oh, no, shit's happening, then, you know, the campaign kind of could write itself from there.
Yeah. I think people get really tangled up when they only planned one outcome, and the players went into door number two instead of door number one, and now they don't. Now they have to think on their feet. And
just don't give them any doors,
right? Don't. So, like, I think we'll do a show on the art of railroading. It's on our list of things to talk about. And like my solution to the problem of the two doors things that don't offer a choice if there's not a choice.
Mm-hmm. If there's a right and a wrong answer, don't even make it a choice.
Don't even make it a choice. Just
unless
only...
the wrong answer is also equally cool.
Right. But the other thing is that the orcs are in the forest no matter which way you go, which is another thing, which is part of the... Well, we're definitely going to have to do the art of railroading.
Yeah. It's a very subtle art,
it's a much maligned art. If you do present a choice, but you didn't plan out the choice, whatever was behind door number one is still behind door number two. And... people will get mad at me for saying this, that like, oh, you've given them the illusion of choice. But if you're the person who has planned it and you didn't think about what was behind door number two, Henry's mad at me. He's messaging me that like, if they pick door number two and you just switch it over, when they come back to door number one, you've also bought yourself time to think about what was behind door number one. And if you don't tell them, they will literally be none the wiser that you didn't have
that
plan.
Nobody's
going to
know. Exactly. Don't worry about it.
Right.
The Invisible Railroad.
So, yeah, the art of railroading. So, what I say you actually need in your intangibles, besides, like, you don't have to be a good character actor. I mean, I happen to be.
Mm.
But but what you actually need is confidence and the ability to make firm decisions as well as arbitrate disagreement, because people are going to disagree with you and they're going to disagree with each other. And your job is to manage the group's enjoyment, not be the be-all and end-all of like rules advice. I've seen a ton of new GM advice that's like, know all the rules. That is fucking horse shit. anyone with a search function or an index can reference a rule. You do not need a system master to run a game.
You have the entire internet in your pocket. You don't have to know all the rules.
You have your tablet with a control F, or you have a book with an index or a table of contents. Like, if you don't know how a rule works, look it up. You don't need to have system mastery to run a game. We need to abandon this idea. But yeah, being a GM is basically leadership skills. And it's a great place to practice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a good way of looking at it.
Yeah. So
yeah, you're just there to make sure everybody has a good time.
Yeah.
And you're not there to win at being a GM. there's no prize at the end other than everyone going, that was really cool.
Right.
Which is, you know, it's warm and fuzzy and all, but.
So let's talk about actually doing the thing.
No. Talking about it is so much more fun, Monica.
I know.
I don't actually want to do the thing. That's scary.
It is. So, you know, all your players are in front of you. You have worked the magic of scheduling. Oh, God, the magic of scheduling. Mm. Pizza's on its way, so now you actually have to run the game. Now what?
I don't know.
I think Apocalypse World actually has some of the best directives for the actual act of running a game. Because as I said before, you're not just the arbiter of rules, you're the arbiter of enjoyment, and that's way more important. I had a note to myself to be prepared for this, and I totally am not, but like the Apocalypse World MCing chapter includes things like call the characters by name, and be a fan of the player characters, and like make your move but never speak its name, and tell the possible consequences and ask, and like all these things are really important to actually doing the thing. They were all things that I had been doing, and then I read that chapter and I was like, oh shit, somebody's put that into words.
Yeah, I wish I had the opportunity to play more Powered by the Apocalypse games, because I've only been in a couple, but I have all the PDFs, and it's fucking great. Like, even if you're not gonna run like Apocalypse World or Dungeon World, you should still read the Apocalypse World.
Oh God, yes.
Like everything, because just a lot of that stuff changed. Maybe it didn't change how I think about it, but gave me the words to explain. Like, this is why you use this technique. This is why you call people by their character names. But you're like, I've run quite a few games, like in real life and in like text and voice chat. And the first session is still the fucking worst. Like I'm always nervous. I never know where to start. All I can say is, try to start as close to the action as possible. I know, it's scary. The first word is always the hardest. But try to get as close to action and setting and interaction and conflict as you can to really just immediately like, okay, we're playing the game now. And this might mean doing some judicious montaging to get everybody in the same spot or on the same page or in the same timeline. You may even have to like start with like some narrative exposition and then immediately be like, okay, now you're fighting in a warehouse. Again, like Apocalypse World says, start with some leading questions for specific players that launch them right into the consequences of something they've done before the game even started. Like, so-and-so is bearing down on you with a bat full of nails. What did you do to piss him off? Like, and they're on their toes. They're already thinking about, I don't know. What did I do to piss him off?
Yeah. And if you have a pretty good player, they'll bounce right back with like, that's old fuckface. I hate him.
old fuckface nail bat.
Yeah. And you know, and then you may not have wanted to name that NPC fuckface nail bat, but guess what?
That's his name.
Yeah, I mean, I've done this a lot. I even did it professionally once. And the first session still gives me anxious and excited butterflies. I usually get comfortable a few minutes in, and then we get rolling. And I mean, a lot of the times directing players into the action is part of that art of railroading. And sometimes it's just transparency, like, okay, buy into this.
work with me here. We're playing a game. I don't care who you are, but you're in this bar right now.
Right. Actually, I think beginning you're all in a bar is a pretty terrible beginning because it's static.
Yeah, unless it's like you're in a bar and it's on fire.
Right.
Like, oh shit.
One of the most entertaining beginnings of a campaign I've ever been in was a retro clone of basic D&D, and the party was all squatting in a house that we were renting it. It was dubious how legally we were living there. And then Henry was like, "You wake up, and someone has stolen your wall." You're going to have to figure out who stole the wall.
The wall? It really brought the room together.
Right? It was keeping the whole house up. We're not really sure how it's still standing. But I bring up that as an example because that also immediately set the tone for the entire game. Our party's dwarf was obsessed with making togas out of other people's pack roll blankets. Like,
okay.
Yeah. It got progressively bigger the longer the game went on. He was also obsessed with obtaining a sail of sky sailing and other weird things. So, like, my magic user, which in this particular retro clone is like a combination fighter wizard, so I was leveling up much slower than everybody else, but she was desperate for a boyfriend. So, that, like, we didn't really have high motives when we began a game beginning with somebody has stolen your wall. So yeah, put your players in the action, give them something to grasp onto immediately. If you are running an adventure, and there is nothing wrong with running a canned adventure, I don't particularly enjoy it, but hey, if that's what you've got because you're playing in like a D&D Adventurers League or whatever, cool. Before the game, ask everybody to buy into it. Don't tell them to be dicks and be like, "Oh, I'm just going to try to book the adventure." P.S. I'm also that asshole.
God, Monica.
I am simultaneously the best and the worst to play with. Set your tone. Get everybody ready to go. We'll talk about player engagement in a later show, too.
And maybe we'll have a little, like, rehabilitation episode for you. How not to be a dick player.
How not to be a dick player. I'm not a dick player. You've run from me several times. I'm not terrible.
Have I?
You have, at least twice.
Did I?
Do you not remember Lycans, the slug girl?
Slug girl.
Yeah, we had that in the Godblooded game.
Oh,
I typed in all lowercase letters as a voice.
I had that Godblooded game with the weird fucking, like, I was like, I'm going to run like a Groundhog Day loop. And right. the first session, I got cold feet. I was like, this is terrible. Nobody likes it. And I stopped running it. Don't do that, guys. Unless your players are like legitimately like, I don't know if this is working for us. I don't know if it, you know, like, don't just like peter out. I don't know. Monica, was it okay? Was it an okay game?
Yeah, it was very memorable. Was it, I think Vivian and was in it too. Like, anytime there's Yumi and Vivian, it's going to get weird.
Weird.
Yeah, so what else? Anything else we think we need to add? Any words of wisdom to impart? Besides, don't squirrel out. Like, I understand anxiety is a bitch, but do your best. Keep
yeah,
going.
Yeah, stick with it.
Yeah, stick
and
with it.
And that first session and sometimes even the second session is just nerve-wracking, and you'll be shaky and kind of sweaty and tired. But, I mean, if your players are having fun, just... You should stick with it, because it does get easier. You'll get better at knowing what you need to bring, what you need to know, what you should prepare. Every one of these, every game and every GM is going to need different things. Just do it.
I mean, just do it.
Running a game is really fun. You pick up a lot of different, very weird skills, like character acting and getting five adults in the same room at the same time for 2 hours every other week. And
sometimes for 5 hours once a month.
And honestly, learning how to run the game will make you a better player, because you'll kind of, you know, you'll have a better understanding of the rules, but you also understand a little more of like what actually goes into, like, you'll know how the sausage is made. You'll know more what's expected of you, and having been on the other side of the screen, you'll know what you want out of a player. Like, you'll have your dream player ideal, and then when you go back to being a player again, you'll be like, oh, I want to be that guy. I don't want to be fuckface nail bat who's like, I know we're running a can adventure, but I'm going over here.
Right. Yeah. That's
Mr.
good.
Nailbat is my father. Call me fuckface.
That's good. That's good advice. I don't know that I have anything better to say.
All right.
Cool.
Everybody out.
Thanks everybody for listening. In case you forgot from about 30 minutes ago, we're bonus experience. We will be back next time, hopefully, with some more in-depth advice for GMing and writing games.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What she said.
Signing off.
Bye, Monica.
Bye. Thanks for listening. Bonus Experience is filmed live before a fictional studio audience in Sigil. We are written and produced by Monica and Ray. Our theme song is Reuse Noise with the Light by CDK and is used under the Attribution Non-Commercial Creative Commons license. Our logo and art is done by Nino Studios. Check her out at Nino, that's N-E-N-O, Studios on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Thanks again, and see you in the next episode.